Tonight, Tony Judd, one of the world's leading historians and public intellectuals, in a passionate plea to remember the values of social democracy as he himself lies terminally ill in New York. And I go underwater, at least metaphorically, with a composer who believes that you can hear the music of the grass singing or the river wailing. More from Bill Fontana later. Plus, dystopian novels are winning literary prizes in Putin's Russia. Later we talk about why such fiction is so rampant there. But first, Tony Judd, whose 2005 book on the history of post-war Europe is, in my view, magisterial. He's written much else, been shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize, won the Haran Arendt Prize, and become a public intellectual with books and essays on subjects from Israel to the war in Iraq, from socialism to financial capitalism. More recently, diagnosed with motor neurone disease, he's been writing from a sickbed. And it seems a miracle of sorts that in such a condition, and he is in the late stage of that terminal illness, he's written at all. Never mind crafted such a passionately lucid book as his new one, Ill Fares the Land. With market capitalism in crisis, Tony Judd asks us to remember the world that we once had before 1979 and all that, a world we've now lost, social democracy and its values. When he spoke to me down the line from his bed, I began by asking him if his ambition in this new book is to rescue social democracy from the enormous condescension of posterity.
If we simply mythologize the wonderful history of social democracy or the sort of halcyon years of welfare Britain, we're going to tell ourselves silly stories that we won't be able to look to a practical future. So what I wanted to do in the book was somehow capture both the complicated realities and shortcomings of the old system of welfare and social democracy, but also its real virtues, real qualities which tend to get lost.
I agree with that, but you and I are of an age, so we grew up in this world, and I remember it as a tougher world than you describe. There's no reference to racism. When you and I went to university, only 5% of us went. There were much tougher exclusions than sometimes I think you're quite willing to acknowledge in this book.
What I tried to do was say, look, there were aspects of this past, the past that grew out of the depression of World War II, of the political extremes of the 30s, which we have neglected, which may still be of some benefit to us. I wouldn't want to claim for a minute that everything is bathed in a nostalgic glow of 50s pleasantness, as it were. I remember that well too, after all.
It's very hard when you get to your and my age, as it were, not in that sense to stake one's colours around the world in which one grew up.
I remember the 50s pretty well, though I have very mixed feelings about it. I remember prejudice at school. I happen to be Jewish. I remember very well anti-Semitism in school. I remember prejudice against West Indian immigrants. I remember all manner of stupid attitudes towards censorship, homosexuals, and frankly towards women as well. So all of these things have changed immensely for the better, but many, many things have changed for the worse.
If you had to identify one strand of social democracy, as it were, that you want to rescue and feed into this, I'm right in saying that it would be the importance of state action, which is much easier to argue for now after the kind of financial fiasco through which we've just lived.
Absolutely. But that could change again in a year or two if people start to forget as we do. I think if there was one aspect of the past that we have lost that I would want to retrieve, it would not be so much state action per se, which after all can be good or bad, but a certain collective capacity to imagine that the state is a vehicle for doing good things, that the state is the way you achieve a better society, the state is the way you achieve justice, the state is the way you increase equality and so on. If we look at the state as a problem, as an expense, as corrupt, as taxing us, as inefficient or inconvenient, we shall never achieve again the kind of collective ambition that marked our best years.
I just remember being very shocked in the 80s when I read Julian Legrand's work, who comes from the left, making it perfectly clear that the state's operations in the welfare state actually benefited largely the middle class.
Remember that one of the reasons that the welfare states of the 40s and 50s benefited the middle class so much was because those who designed them in England, in Germany, in Holland, in France, knew perfectly well that it was the middle classes who had been alienated in the 1930s from liberal democracy, that you had to bind them back into a world of collective purpose, rule of law, and so on. So it's not untrue that the welfare state benefited the middle class, but it wasn't such a terrible thing either.
Depends which class you were born into is one response to that.
Well, I was not born into the middle class myself, I can assure you. But having said that, I sort of ascended into it via the natural 60s route, which was the educational meritocracy. And I think that what was in many ways best about 1950s and 60s Britain was the assumption, not that the middle class would disappear and we would all become welfareized workers, but that everyone had the real possibility of ascending into that middle class. Why is that so bad?
I think one of the most interesting parts of the book is, in a sense, your argument the left, socialism, social democracy, should value prudence. After all, it was Marx who said, you know, that capitalism melted everything into thin air. Right. You're sceptical of novelty.
Well, of course, that's partly because, like you, are of a certain generation. We tend not to be very novelty-focused by this age. But I would add this, that it's a 1960s myth that everything gets better. The younger you are, the better it is. The newer it is, the better it is. The future will be better than the past, and so on. We have good reason, looking back over the 20th century, to question that. As I look into the 21st century, I think we're in for quite a tough time. And some of the lessons we learned the last time we passed through tough times may be serviceable. Those are lessons about prudence, about collective action rather than individual competition. They're also lessons about the idea, the danger, that politics don't necessarily stay stable and safe, democratic and liberal, forever. They can go in very strange directions. They've done it before.
You very clearly rescue the nation state, and I think there's a kind of celebratory mood in the book about this. It's the nation state that's having to put its house in order. There may be an economic global system, but actually there's a series of national states that've had to cope with this financial tsunami. And if I understand you right, you're not sorry to see the resurgence of the importance of the nation state.
In a way, that's true. When people vote, when they think about who they want to govern them, who they want to live with, who their fellow citizens are, what they're willing to sacrifice for them, what taxes they'll pay and why they pay them, what services they want, those are all national sentiments, national decisions. What the global economy does is put great pressure on those national political systems to respond to circumstances they can't really influence very much. But the politics remain local, so we had better accept that rather than pretending that we live in a global world.
But you wrote a very good book about post-war Europe, and one of the absences from this book is any reference, in effect, to the European Union. You think these kind of blocks, as one might call the European Union, don't constitute an identity, don't constitute a defensible political space.
I think they constitute what you might call, I suppose, for want of a better word, cultural spaces. Europe is a very real cultural space in which there are norms and laws, habits of life, collective interests, ways of behaving, ways of living and working and having leisure, which are very different from those of Asia or America or Africa. And those are real differences.
And are they better?
Well, in some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. I live in the United States. I'm speaking from New York. And I can tell you that in many respects, the European way of life, with exceptions, is a much better way of life than the American one. But it doesn't mean it's a better place. It just means it's got better institutions. And I think the institutions are what my book is about.
Well, oddly enough, you know, I'm going to disagree with you because I don't think it really is about institutions. The power of the book is actually your longing, and longing's a good word in my vocabulary, a longing for what you call a moral narrative. I actually think what you feel we need now isn't, you know, a better parliament, which we may need, or better European Union institutions, right, which we may need, but actually a story we can tell ourselves about ourselves that in a proper sense will make us feel better about ourselves, not by lying to us about ourselves, but by answering to a real social and material condition.
Well, that I agree, and I stand corrected. I think that what I tried to write in the book was a sort of plea to reopen a sort of ethical conversation about what kind of society we want to live in. Not a conversation about how to be efficient, how to be wealthy, how to succeed, how to improve GDP, or how to achieve goal A, B, or C, but how to imagine a better society. Now, for that, we need institutions, we need policies, but above all, we need to be able to understand what it is we want. We can't do that if we can't think about it. We don't have the language. So I'm trying to encourage the resurgence of an ethical language of politics.
I think the tension in the book, and I don't think it's resolved, is between an interest in the state and an interest in society. And part of the interest of society, it's always been more than politics. And the book moves towards, then moves away from a kind of religious language, because I think it was Proudhon, the great anarchist, who said, you know, in the end, we only have the language of believers, even if we don't ourselves believe.
Something has happened to the language of not so much morals, but of moral confidence. I was a close observer for various reasons of the last pope, who I met a number of times. I'm not Catholic, I'm not religious. I didn't necessarily admire many of his positions. But I was struck by how young people responded not to the substance of what he said. Many things people didn't like what he said about abortion or women, but the clarity and confidence with which he said it. And what we have lost, what we desperately need to recover, is a kind of confidence in the possibility of moral certitude. I don't mean being better than other people. I mean not being so uncertain about the values we hold and the reasons we hold them. That's a kind of opposing the lazy relativism that my generation introduced into public conversation.
It's good to see a little self-flagellation from all of us, I think, in these
circumstances. Well, look, I mean, someone once said to me, your book is an attack on the 60s, but I'm very conscious that my generation, the baby boom generation, not only had it easy, that's a cliche, I know that, but that we very particularly unraveled many of the rather firm, perhaps over-firm, nostrums of the generations before us. That we replaced them with nothing very much except an enthusiasm for individualism, for letting the self achieve whatever goals it set itself. And the paradox, of course, therefore, is that it was the 60s left which is substantially responsible for breaking down the confidence in collective ideas, collective ambitions, collective institutions, which the old left had built up 20 years before.
I understand that, and it's a very powerful part of the book. But, you know, from Workers of the World Unite to Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, the truth is communities are always imagined. And actually, when you said community and space, I thought this is when Tony Judd is actually trapped in a 45 model.
Oh, OK, well, it's a fair criticism, except I don't accept it. look, it's true that, you know, the notion that communities are imagined, that there's no such thing as a natural community, is a well-established academic trope. There are a lot of good, very smart people out there who think that nations are created or imagined or invented and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that we do live in real spaces. We don't live in the ether. There's a reason why Norwegians feel, so to speak, much more coherent as a community of political purpose. Numbers and space make it much harder to feel part of a collectivity. I'm not saying that we should live in small, tight, little white communities. It's perhaps rather sad, and it may well be a major problem. But it is a fact of social life.
It is a fact, and it isn't a fact, because whatever chair you are sitting on and whatever equipment is here in the BBC studio has probably been manufactured somewhere east of the Western world. And in that sense, the economic community, our sustenance, is born of people we will never meet. The community that sustains us is genuinely a global community. Politically, it may not be, but economically, it certainly is.
What strikes me is the opposite point. that given that we live in this remarkably complicated global society from the point of view of commodities and exchange and money and movement, it is striking how much we still live in real, physical, constricted spaces for the purpose of trust, for the purpose of identity, for the purpose of language, and for the purpose of collective life. It's no good denying that. If we deny it, we will not understand the nature of modern politics.
As I listen to you, I also think, given the illness you've got, that sense you've just used the word of constriction must be very kind of palpable to you. I remember Raymond Williams, the cultural critic, saying of Orwell that when Orwell was writing 1984, he was very ill. That sense of kind of physical incarnation must be very acute to you at present.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, I'm talking to you, as I said, from New York. I'm lying on the bed. I'm completely immobile. I'm speaking through a sort of air contraption which enables me to breathe. And so I'm merely a sort of mummified, disembodied head. But having said that, and not in the least complaining about it, since there's nothing I can do about it, so complaint is pointless. It does have a kind of liberating dimension. It means that I can think free of my physical circumstances. Now, I realize that most people can't. So if I try to imagine a world free of physical circumstances, I'm being very unrealistic. And it's not an account of anything that actually exists for most people. But in my slightly odd world, I've had this motor neuron disease for 18 months now. I really do live inside the sort of virtual space of my own head. And that means that I am both the prisoner in a body which is steadily shrinking in terms of its capacities and will eventually constrict me to death. But I'm also completely free to think and talk and imagine and argue unrestrained by the usual physical limitations. It goes both ways.
The unrestrained Tony Judd and his book Ill Fares the Lands, published by Alan Lane. Turner, Monet, Debussy, Handel. Artists have always been drawn to water, but no one, to my knowledge, has made water so integral an element to their work as Bill Fontana has in his new piece River Soundings, which opens later this week in the subterranean depths of Somerset House on London's Strand. In the publicity, Bill Fontana's described as a sound sculptor, but I was delighted to hear him, when I spoke to him, describe himself as a composer. All that distinguishes him is that he uses the sounds of nature as his bars and quavers. He began as a minimalist composer in San Francisco and went on to record sounds and orchestrate them. He's done this from the Venice Biennale to Tate Modern, and the titles tell all. Distant Trains, Satellite for Earbridge, Cologne, San Francisco are just two of them. His new work centres on the sounds of water mixed with foghorns and the bells of the boys, as well as images, and it's installed in Somerset House, but not in its grand upper rooms. It's in its lower depths, in the corridors and light wells or coal houses which punctuate them. I began my conversation with Bill Fontana at the top of some frightening stone stairs. Bill, where are you taking me? I know we're going down some vertiginous stairs.
Well, we're in Somerset House about to begin an acoustic and architectural journey into the light wells of this old palace.
So we've just opened what looks to me like a coal shed.
Right, these are coal halls, but the river used to come into the building, and where we're standing now in the lower level of the light wells is actually in the level of the Thames. Here's Millennium Bridge.
It's just the struts, I think, is the technical term,
right,
holding them together inside one of these dark, desolate places. Let's go inside.
We're in a coal hole off the light wells, and the image that's being projected is a close-up view of some of the cables on the London's Millennium Bridge. And the sounds you're hearing are from an accelerometer on some of these cables. And this...
So I'm actually hearing the sound of the cables.
The sounds of these cables, yes. But it's not a sound that you would hear if you were standing there. It's a sound that you might hear if you put your ear on it, but an accelerometer is a very, very sensitive sort of way to enter the material and find out what the material is doing.
There's a line in George Eliot's Middlemarch where she says, if we could hear the sound of grass singing, we would die the other side of silence. That's what you're after, isn't it?
Yes.
If you could hear the grass singing.
Well, I could.
Singing.
I could.
You can hear the grass singing.
I could.
I like that. With your technology,
I could put a micro sensor on the grass, and you'd hear it, the material of the grass reacting to the wind. You'd hear it rubbing, the grass rubbing with each other. You'd find a whole universe of sound in that.
And is this something to do... Were you born in San Francisco?
No, I was born in Cleveland.
So you were born in the middle of the kind of cornfields?
Well, Cleveland is an old by American standards, industrial city.
I suppose what I'm trying to work out is how you got from that industrial city to this kind of saturation in nature.
I grew up within walking distance to the Cleveland Orchestra. And I was born with a love of music. And at a certain point during my adolescence, I guess I started... I used to think there was something wrong with me because I would start to hear sounds as being as beautiful as music. And I used to think, that must be a bit nuts.
So, in a way, you're trying to find the musicality in everyday life.
Exactly, exactly.
And in those circumstances, there are moments when I think of you like you belong... I mean, you started as a minimalist composer, but I think of you as belonging to that great nature tradition that takes you back to John Muir, the great 19th century nature writer of Yosemite Park. You're trying to find the kind of... the rhythms of everyday life.
Rhythms of everyday life and listening to the world with a natural ear. And I came to regard making music, for me the act of listening is a way of making music. And so for years I've used sound recording as a way to sort of investigate what that is. I've done this for 40 years all over the world.
You're an old West Coast romantic, really, aren't
you? An old West Coast romantic, yes, yes.
And in those kinds of circumstances, you know, Cage's notion, you know, that if music is noise, all noise is music, that's not your position at all, really, is it?
Well, it is in a way, and it isn't in a way, because Cage used to always say in his lectures that music is continuous and listening is intermittent. And the music that's continuous is the ability of the listener to find and create music out of what he hears in the continuum of noise. You know, there's no noise if somebody's listening, it's music.
And would it matter if you'd invented this in some digital workshop, these sounds?
Yes, yes, it would.
It would matter.
Yes.
Tell me why. Because to the listener, you know, Maupassant, he said, realists are just the best liars. So actually, it wouldn't matter, would it?
Well, I don't know if I could have simulated this sound so readily in an electronic music studio. I probably could have, but I find that the sounds I find in real situations have a sort of richness to them and a timbre to them that would be hard to find. I mean, if you listen closely to this hydrophone that's sort of plunged into this fast-moving water under in the Teddington Weir, I mean, how would you imagine that sound if you hadn't found it?
You're of the same generation as Terry Riley,
yes,
and that group. And actually, this water doesn't sound a million miles from certain minimalist sort of rhetoric.
Right, well, it is. It is part of that tradition, I suppose.
And are you still a composer in music who uses natural sounds? If somebody asks you that, what's on your passport?
Well, I mean, I regard myself as a composer, but I mean, I don't write music with notes. I write music with my ears.
In those circumstances, of course, there's also there's a long history of making music about the sea, you know,
yes,
from Debussy
sure
through to and so on and so on. Are you part of that tradition too?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, for example, I have a permanent installation outside of London in Greenwich at the National Maritime Museum. About 10, 11 years ago, when they opened that new building, they'd actually commissioned me to make a study of the sound of the sea along the British coast. And they asked me to select what I thought was the most musical and interesting one. And I fell in love with Chesil Beach in Dorset. And if you go into the entrance of the National Maritime Museum, you'll actually hear a permanent installation based on Chesil Beach.
Now, we're hearing what keeps coming, which I assume is the bell of a buoy.
There's a bell buoy out in the Thames Estuary and a foghorn.
And that's, I mean, there's a line of T.S. Eliot's I can't remember from the Four Quartets about that. And, of course, I thought of the opening of Dry Salvages, you know, the dark god is a sullen dark right. god, the river. I mean, has literature sort of entered your mind when you think of these places? Are you a real composer for whom the word doesn't matter any more than the image?
Well, the
matters?
Word kind of matters to me after the fact, but I think the initial fact is kind of more the ecstasy of discovering the sound.
Now we're going to go actually indoors down a long corridor where there's at the far end, there is a projection of what looks to me like, is it Chelsea Bridge or Victoria?
A tower bridge.
A tower bridge.
And I was fascinated by this the view of this, because you see this large circular image. It's sort of like an eye, and it's like a London eye.
Of course, as we come to Tower Bridge, one of the things that it makes me think is the Thames has been a place of power.
Yes.
You know, a profound place. And, of course, where we're stood, Somerset House, as far as I remember, the man who built Somerset House, the Duke of Somerset, was in the end executed for treason,
right.
to Besmar. Now, I'm interested, what are the limits to what you do? Because, to put it this way, Bill, what are the sounds of power? How do you give power a sound? Because this place, the Thames, have been profoundly sounds of power.
I'll show you.
Okay, you show us.
Because this part of Somerset House has a nickname. It's called the Death House. Because when we come to the end of this passage, you'll see the gravestones that relate to the Catholic nobility that used to inhabit this building. And this is perhaps my favorite one.
Do you want to read it to us?
Well,
you see it?
I see it. It says Dr. Flavius.
Yeah, I need better light in order to see that. But tell me why this attracts you.
Well, because graphically you have the image of a skull and crossbones, and it's sort of a power. It's a power here because of the architecture creates this sort of reverberation in the low frequencies, and the sound that's causing that is I took underwater recording of the Thames that had some deep frequencies in it, and when I play it just out of the subwoofers here, it really makes the space boom.
It has a curious kind of elegiac air to it.
Yeah, I would say that.
Bill Fontana, thank you very much.
Bill Fontana. And River Sounding runs at Somerset House in London until the end of May. The recent US television series The Wire, set in Baltimore about power, drugs and the law, was the best TV ever made, at least according to some critics. So the latest work from its begetter, David Simon, was always going to generate great expectations. Trey May, which is already scheduled for 10 episodes, is set in post-Katrina New Orleans, weaving the music of the city into the fabric of its storylines.
What hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast was a natural disaster, a hurricane, pure and simple. The flooding of New Orleans was a man-made catastrophe of epic proportions and decades in the making.
John Goodman as an English professor in the first episode of David Simon's new series, Tremé. Well, it aired last night in the US and Dinah Roberts sat there with Beth Breath Baited for Nightwaves. When we spoke earlier, I asked her if David Simon had managed to keep in play all the paradoxes and contradictions that are rooted in New Orleans, that it's European and African, pagan and Christian, a place of suffering, a place of pleasure.
I think Simon has absolutely mobilized all those paradoxes, because this is a city that stood for pleasure that we watched suffer in very great pain during and in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I think he consciously chose to set Treme 3 months after Katrina, when the full extent of the disaster was starting to be understood.
I mean, you've only seen one episode, Diane. Does he do what he does in The Wire, which is pull together a variety of worlds and the kind of incompatible becomes compatible?
Yes, he does. We have characters from the upper echelons of New Orleans society, Garden District people, a professor of literature at Tulane, a civil rights lawyer from the privileged white world, right on down to street people. We've got a trombone player played by Wendell Pierce, who was also in The Wire. It really is the usual David Simon Dickensian cast of characters and a highly involved storytelling, very elliptical.
Because you mentioned the trombonist. I mean, New Orleans is kind of music. And when I heard Simon was doing this, my heart slightly sank, because it's very easy to kind of settle into all black people got rhythm sort of New Orleans, which is what Mardi Gras is.
Well, exactly. And I'm happy to say this is not that. In fact, it's very cleverly done in that Treme is a neighborhood, a faubourg, as they would say in New Orleans, which is adjacent to the French Quarter, but not a touristy place. It contains Congo Square, which is very important in the history of jazz. And if nothing else, Simon is brilliant at taking what might appear to be a stereotype and subverting it completely. So, you know, a Mardi Gras Indian, he turns this into a real person, a trombone player. Well, this guy isn't your sort of tragic jazz man. It really does take in the breadth of New Orleans society, which is the most racially mixed in all of America.
And the music, is the music integrated, to use the word properly? Is this operatic?
Well, I think it is, in a way, from the theme song, which is a song about Treme, to the eruptions, is the best way to put it, of music in the piece. There are real musicians. There's Alan Toussaint. There's a cameo by Elvis Costello. There's Dr. John. It erupts the way it erupts in New Orleans. You can be sitting there having a drink, and along will come a jazz band, and that's normal.
In terms of The Wire and Treme's progenitors, they're not only Simon, but they're HBO. Now, HBO has a kind of halo round its head in Britain, because British people like beating themselves over their back, saying how terrible British drama is compared with American drama. Do you think HBO is developing the most interesting drama on the planet?
I do at the moment. I think HBO, the people who work there and work with it, learned from British television of, say, a decade ago, which was then the most interesting television on the planet. And you notice how often American television steals from British television, The Office, etc. But right now, HBO seems to be a creative epicenter, and David Simon appears to be the beating heart in that epicenter. That's a horribly mixed bunch of metaphors, but you know what I mean. I mean, David Simon, because I think of his background as a newspaper man, as indeed a city reporter in Baltimore, he pays attention to detail like no one I know of. And this is a very detailed series. It actually begins with very close shots of a guy working a reed to put into an instrument and a black-gloved hand. Enigmatic, but very beautifully rendered detailed shots.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because the way you describe it and the way people who like The Wire, and I'm an agnostic where The Wire comes into being, all of the people describe it in sociological terms. And you're right, of course, Simon was a kind of city reporter. But is this kind of pleasurable and aesthetically kind of riveting, or is it just sociologically fascinating?
Well, I think both The Wire and Treme are pleasurable and riveting in a dramatic sense. People walk in and out of episodes of a David Simon program, and you don't know who they are for a long time, and you just have to go with him. And that absolutely works for me. There are people who can't stand it.
Are you going to be sat on the edge of your seat for the next 10 episodes?
Oh, I think I'll be lounging on my sofa with a Sazerac or a brandy milk punch. That's the right way to watch New Orleans television.
It probably is. Thanks very much to Dinah Roberts. And you're listening to Night Waves with me, Philip Dodd. And if you want to listen to the last four programmes or to our Arts and Ideas podcast, which contains my interview with Philip Pullman, just log on to the BBC website. Russia was the only developed country where absolute poverty increased during the 1990s, that decade when liberation from what was seen as the old Soviet regime was celebrated. The war in Chechnya, terrorist bombs on the Moscow underground, a president, Putin, who stepped down only to become prime minister. These are just some of the other happenings which provide mulch for dystopian imaginations. So perhaps it's not surprising that Russian dystopian novelists are thriving, winning prizes. One such is Dmitry Bukov, whose Living Souls imagines a Russia in the near future, riven by civil war. With Aryan Russians on one side, liberals and Jewish people on the other, it's coruscating and comic. A sign of the temper of one strand of Russian writing, perhaps. Joining me to discuss the dystopian life of post-Soviet Russian literature are the writer and broadcaster Konstantin Egert, on the line from Moscow, and Oliver Reddy, research fellow in Russian literature at Oxford University. I wonder, rather than starting with the present, Oliver, if we could let a whiff of history into this. It isn't as if dystopian literature is alien to Russia, is it?
No, certainly not. I mean, the word dystopian, of course, is widely used to mean any nightmarish vision of the future, and Russian literature has had more than its fair share of those, but then so has American literature, for example. But I think it's more meaningful if we take the word dystopian in a more narrow sense in its connection with utopia. So a dystopia is a negative utopia, and a dystopian novel is one which generally shows us what would happen if the ideal of a utopian society was actually realized in practice. And it shows that what would happen, of course, is not the paradise on earth that it's cracked up to be, but a kind of hell on earth.
Where do you identify the beginning of this kind of dystopian traditions?
Well, I think the most important first wave was, not surprisingly, in the first decade after 1917, in the 1920s, when, of course, you have many writers who feel themselves as individuals to be outside of this collective paradise that they're supposed to be living in, who feel that this is a very excessively rationalist construction of the future that has no space for human feeling, for art. Zamyatin's novel We, it's perhaps the most famous example of that.
Which itself then echoed down into Orwell's 1984.
Echoed down and looked back to Dostoevsky, who in many senses prophesied the dystopian society.
Well, then I wonder
50
if we,
years earlier.
I wonder if we can bring in Konstantin and sort of bring it up to date. These novels that are being translated here and others well, Konstantin, do you think, as in a sense, they're good exports from Russia because they echo a Western account of what Russian literature is really like, which is dark at the heart of its soul?
I think yes. I think also most of these books are, I would say, easily commercialized. I mean, you can sell them because people will probably grasp the and different contexts, I would say, the irony and the thrill of some of these novels. I mean, some of them are pretty interesting to read as just, you know, thrillers. I also think that to some extent, probably I would agree with Oliver, all the new dystopias are actually not dystopias as such. They are sometimes smart, sometimes not very smart, comments on what goes on in Russia today. And I think this is something that is quite interesting because most Russian writers, to my mind, lack the ability and the instruments to describe Russian reality, so they try to go either back or forward.
Perhaps I could come in there. Yes, I mean, I think you're right that these are not really dystopian novels, this new wave. I think Russian literature has had its fill of utopias and dystopias, and there probably aren't any utopias left to subvert. I mean, apart from the communist utopia, there was the capitalist utopia, which was more of a farce than anything in Russia in the 1990s, and that was sent up so well by Viktor Pelevin, perhaps the best-known post-Soviet writer in the West. And I think the point about that these writers are trying to entertain is very important. I think what we're seeing with this new cohort of writers who are being exported to the West and who are being brought over is that they're trying to make, to engage the reader again, to make Russian literature entertaining again. I mean, in the 1990s, all faith in Russian writers was lost to a large extent among Russian readers and faith in the intelligentsia. And most people started reading very popular novels, and it was there that, you know, the dramas of the present were played out. And Russian writers are trying to claim that back now, I think.
Well, if Oliver's right, Konstantin, there still is, and you both agree these are not dystopian novels because in a sense there are no utopias against which you can play dystopia, then the question is, why does Russian literature like what one might call the near future? We, that great 20s book, obviously, is set in the far future, but a lot of these books are set in the near future. Why is there no direct address in these books, do you think, to Russia now?
First of all, I think people are afraid to imagine what's going to happen, I know, in 50 years, for example. Secondly, they probably don't even know how to imagine it, because in Russia today, you can barely imagine what's going to happen tomorrow, not even speaking about next year or something like that. This is a society which is atomized, very much cynical, very much self-centered and individualistic, and frankly, not very much caring for the future. I think this is one of the most interesting phenomenon here, as compared especially to Central and Eastern Europe, is that people actually do not feel there is a future. They live by one day, I'm sorry. Oliver probably could take us back to the depths of Russian literature, which probably he knows even better than I do. But I think this is a kind of constanta that exists in the Russian mind.
Do you think that's true, Oliver?
Yes, but all I'd say is that these new writers are trying to do something other than present a kind of apocalyptic vision of Russia's future. I mean, Olga Slavnikova, I think, stylistically and in many ways the most interesting of the new writers to be translated, is actually writing about love in her novel. I mean, it's been called 2017 and it's promoted as a sort of futurist novel, but it's actually trying to make Russian literature less cynical than it has been for the last 20 years and to try to find authentic values in this postmodernist world.
I would agree about Olga, but others are probably still pretty cynical. And
well, Bukov writes about love as well, but not just about love. But I mean, his novel is a novel of fantasy, of magic. It's an attempt to re-enchant Russia, to go back to the sources of folk culture of the region,
or to make it escape the reality. You know, escapism is very popular today.
Well, I was going to ask you, Konstantin, as it were, what are people reading, as it were, on the buses in Moscow now?
Well, the same rubbish that everyone else reads on buses.
It's good to see there's a cynic in you too, Konstantin.
Of course, yes. I'm part of my people. So people on buses definitely read, not Dostoevsky. I mean, when I see a broadsheet newspaper in someone's hands, I mean, I feel happy for the rest of the day. I do think that there is definitely, I mean, what happened to the Russian book market, if you wish, is something that was actually to be predicted. 80 or 90%, I don't have the statistics, but they read popular literature, you know, cheap thrillers and stuff like that. That's
what Noel Coward called the potency of cheap music. All cultures do that. We're coming to the end. So I want to ask Oliver, are there any dystopian novels about Putin's Russia, do you think?
I think the one that comes closest is one written by Vladimir Sorokin, and it's called The Day of the Oprichnik, perhaps in allusion to Solzhenitsyn's day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, but seen not from the point of view of a prisoner, but from the point of view of a man in a kind of death squad, so a man of power. And I think this novel is playing on the ideology of Putinism, but that's a very pragmatic rather than idealistic ideology, but nevertheless one that wants to have a strong Russia, to make the bond between the church and the state again, in many ways a hypocritical bond as it's shown in the novel, a very assertive Russia. And I think it's a very effective novel because it's written in the first person and very forcefully, and it makes you...
Do you think there are signs of new kinds of literary forms? Because one of the issues with Russian literature, it's weighed down by history that's Turgenev, Dostoevsky, you know, Tolstoy. I mean, are there new kinds of writing emerging, do you think? Because the kind of writing we've been talking about is both new and not new.
You know, I'm waiting for someone to try and seriously assess what happened in Russia in the 80s and 90s. That is, amazingly, there are very few books about it that would be accessible and that would be really standing out. So I think when it happens, we can say that probably some period of Russian history is behind us and there are some really new people. But yes, I feel a bit more optimistic because of the diversity of the people who write today. They're completely young. They probably sometimes don't even remember the Soviet Union. Well, then, and that creates a new world.
Okay, well, I'm afraid, as always, we have to leave it there, as it's always getting more and more interesting. Thanks very much to Oliver Reddy and Konstantin Eggert from Moscow. That's all from Night Waves tonight, but do join us tomorrow when there'll be debate on the principle of compromise with John Gray and an interview with the American performer Laurie Anderson. So join Matthew Sweet and guest tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3 at 9:15. Martin, now back to you.
Thanks so much, Philip. Nightwaves, presented by Philip Dodd, produced by Victoria Shepherd.